that lines, Russia summons the British ambassador in Moscow and accuses London barefaced lies over a maritime incident in the Black Sea. Israel advances plans for 31 new settlement construction projects in the occupied West Bank, the first such move under the new cabinet. And hundreds of unmarked graves are found near another former Catholic Church-run school for Indigenous children in Canada. Hello and welcome everybody here in Iranian capital Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour, Russia has called the presence of a British destroyer off the coast of the Crimean Peninsula unacceptable and against international law. The Kremlin says Russia's border forces would continue to respond to such provocations. Moscow summoned the British ambassador over the incident, accusing London of spreading, quote, barefaced lies. On Wednesday, the Russian Defense Ministry said it had fired warning shots at a British Navy ship that entered its territorial waters in the Black Sea. Britain rejected Russia's account as inaccurate, saying no shots have been fired at HMS Defender. It also claimed the vessel was in the Ukrainian territory and in accordance with international law. The German Chancellor has called on the European Union to seek direct talks with Russia to resolve disputes between the two sides. Angela Merkel said the talks must go on, even if the bloc stands together against what she called provocations against Russia. She said it was not enough for the American president to talk about issues with his Russian counterpart, stressing that the EU must also create different formats for talks. Merkel also called on the 27-member bloc to form a united front against Russia. Her comments drew reaction from Ukraine, with Kiev blasting the proposal as a dangerous deviation from U.S. sanctions policy, or EU sanctions policy, that is. Moscow is at loggerheads with the West over a number of issues, including troop buildup around Ukraine, espionage accusations against Moscow, as well as the case of Alexei Navalny, have added to the tensions. Russia has turned down a request by the UN and other countries to continue authorizing operations at the only border crossing through which humanitarian aid reaches Syria's Idlib region. To discuss that further, we were joined earlier by our guests who weighed in on the matter. Let's listen in. News review, where we look deeper into some of the top stories of the day. On this edition, Russia has turned down a request by the UN and other countries to continue authorizing operations at the only border crossing through which humanitarian aid reaches Syria's Idlib region. Russia's UN ambassador Vasily Nebenzia said such a move would threaten Syria's sovereignty. He maintained that the Idlib region is, quote, a refuge for terrorists. He said the better alternative to transport aid is from Damascus. Negotiations have been launched on a draft resolution brought forth by Ireland and Norway, two non-permanent Security Council members. They want the Bab al-Hawa crossing on the Turkish border to be used for aid deliveries. UN authorization will require a vote before its expiry on July the 10th, but there's great risk of a Russia veto. The border crossing authorization has been in force since 2014. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Elijah Magnier joining us from Brussels. Also, we have international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who's with us from Ontario, London, Ontario. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Magnier. What is if you can, please explain, what is it that the United Nations is requesting in this regard in terms of getting aid into Idlib, and why is Russia opposed to it?
Thank you for having me. What's happening is that the U.S. wants to access the country, which is Syria, through Turkey, and that is in general unacceptable for the sovereignty of Syria as a country and as a sovereign state. By accessing the country through passages from Turkey or from Iraq or Kurdistan or other cross-border that are illegal, that exist between the two countries due to the decade of war, the U.S. is trying to impose an ipso facto on Syria under the reason of the humanitarian support and aid. Now, we have several passages. You have Bab al-Hawa, Bab al-Salam, and the Arabia cross-border, one in the northwest, another one in the north, and the third one is in the northeast. And what the UN are trying to do through the United Nations and the pressure from the US and the UK is to impose on Syria the humanitarian agenda for which they can continue supplying the zone in the north that is still occupied by Turkey, and where there are the Syrian opposition, there are Al-Qaeda, there are still fighters who are against the government in Damascus, and also on the north east, where the U.S. forces are occupying almost 20% of the Syrian territory and refusing to leave the area and allow Syria to move in. Now, the United Nations have tried in the past and succeeded in sending humanitarian aid through Damascus, and I don't know why this should not happen again, and the support should be limited to the area that out of the control of the Syrian government.
Mr. Corrigan, do you agree with Mr. Magnea? This is all just an excuse being pressured and pushed forth by the United States in order to gain access to Syria?
Yes, I largely concur with that conclusion. The United States has got soldiers illegally in, you know, northeastern part of Syria, as do the Turks. The Americans have been stealing massive amounts of oil and using that. It's outright piracy, but they're probably using the money to support the rebels against the Syrian government. And the Americans have been stealing tons of food. So they've got, you know, big shipments of food going out of Syria into Iraq for their own purposes. If they were to leave that food that belongs to the Syrian people alone, I think that would probably solve half of the problems in the area. The Americans also don't want to give Damascus any legitimacy in terms of helping rebuild the country. And they therefore want to have their own control, which is accessing it through Turkey or through Iraq. Now, the Turks are adamantly opposed to the creation of a Kurdish state. So, you know, there's a divergence between what the Turks want, what the Americans want, and what the Syrians want. And you have still, the CIA was funding, you know, Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. So there's still, you know, remnants of that. And they, you know, transferred some of the Daesh or Islamic State, you know, fighters into Iraq, or they're sending them now to Yemen too. But it's a political game, and the Americans want to have as much leverage and control as they can, and they don't want to turn over any or give legitimacy to the Damascus government. But it is Syria. The Syrians have the sovereignty, and the Americans are there illegally and are doing a lot of really terrible things. And you have, you know, it's almost like there's a great potential for clashes between Russian troops and American troops. A couple of days ago, the Russians stopped an American patrol. The Russians are still supporting the Damascus government, as the Damascus government has requested their assistance. And, you know, the American and Turkish forces that are there have no legitimate basis for doing so. They're not invited by the Syrian government. There's no UN Security Council authorization for it. And it is, you know, just it's they're playing games with people's lives and trying to punish the Syrian government for, one, winning the war and not collapsing, and two, for its resistance against, you know, the Turkish-backed groups and also the Al-Qaeda groups, but also the Kurds. And I'm a little sympathetic. The Kurds do have some legitimate issues, and they're even talking to the Damascus government. So, but the Americans are still trying to control the situation, and they're looting, you know, northern Syria. If they stopped doing that, Syria would have a lot more resources, and they would have a lot more food. And there's a study that said that the Syrian war has cost $1.2 trillion. So this is a massive amount of cost to the Syrian people, but it affects the entire Middle East, and even it affects Europe. And you've got, you know, the major countries like China, Russia, India. They never broke relations with the Damascus government, And, you know, it's the Europeans and the Americans and the Israelis that were doing their best to dismember the place, create havoc, and using, you know, Islamic militants in order to try to provoke a civil war and also trying to dismember Syria, which would be a disaster for everybody. The Americans and the British and the French have been playing a very, very dangerous game and also lying to their publics the reason why they were there. And it makes no sense, and it's cost a lot of lives, and it's cost the Americans and the British and the French a lot of money as well. It's irrational is what's going on.
Thank my guests, Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst, joining us from Brussels. Also thanks to international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, joining us from London, Ontario. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Review. Elsewhere, Israel has advanced its plans for 31 new settlement construction projects in the occupied West Bank. This is the first settlement construction approval under the new cabinet in Tel Aviv. The plans include a shopping center, a school, and a number of infrastructure projects. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the West Bank and East Jerusalem on Al-Quds. Israel has recently stepped up its settlement activities backed by the United States and in defiance of UN Security Council Resolution 2334. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. Activist and political commentator Jamal Jonah says Israel is committing crimes with impunity due to support that it receives from the U.S. and some Western countries.
All their aims and their main goals, and they are in race for stealing the Palestinian land, cementing the apartheid system that they are putting in the West Bank. They are putting in danger the Palestinian future to be blocked in this apartheid system, while their resources is being taken and confiscated in the land that they are building settlements on. In what so-called Area C, 62% of the West Bank, all the Palestinian resources is there. We are practicing, and we are, the whole world also sees very well that Israel is an apartheid colonial state. Israel is a criminal state that they are confiscating the Palestinian rights, confiscating the Palestinian future. In this context, I think the international law looks like doesn't applicable to Israel. Like, and Israel has been immune since 1948 from all the crimes that they are committing, and there is no consequences whatsoever. And this is clearly because they have this support, unconditional support, for regardless what they can do, what they can commit crimes from the United States, from the West. And this should be ended.
North Korea has rejected a United States proposal for holding talks. North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Sung-won said his country won't consider any contact that would only waste time. His remarks come after the U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea said he would meet with Pyongyang's representatives without any preconditions. Former U.S. President Donald Trump held two summits with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, but made little diplomatic progress. President Joe Biden says that he will not pursue that policy unless North Korea negotiates its nuclear arsenal with a concrete plan. Jennifer Chang says Washington needs to live up to its previous commitments to reopen a dialogue with Pyongyang.
North Korea gained nothing from the U.S. even after holding three summits with the U.S. President Donald Trump. And they have pretty much made clear with this latest statement by North Korea's Foreign Minister Lee Sung-won that they are not going to hold talks at all with the U.S. Now, after Kim Jong-un's sister Kim Yo-jong had recently stated that the U.S. had unrealistic expectations that the North would be possibly coming back to the negotiating table, there was hope by many observers and experts and analysts that if the U.S. were to compromise more and offer some more concrete incentives for the North to come back to nuclear negotiations with the U.S., that Pyongyang might actually be willing to reopen dialogue with the U.S., but that has not been the case. North Korean Foreign Minister, the top diplomat in the North, made clear today that there are going to be no talks whatsoever with Washington, no matter what Washington offers. So that puts the ball in the U.S. court. Now the U.S. government is under pressure to really live up to its commitment.
Well, China has strongly condemned the United States for imposing sanctions on several more Chinese companies. A foreign ministry spokesman said that Beijing would take all necessary measures to protect the legitimate interests of Chinese firms. That after the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden ordered a ban on imports of key solar panel material from a group of Chinese companies over alleged claims of forced labor. That measure came on top of blacklisting of five Chinese firms by the U.S. Treasury over similar allegations. China earlier called the accusations downright lies with ulterior motives. Washington has placed many Chinese firms on its sanctions list over the past several years, citing different pretexts. Hundreds of unmarked graves have been found near another former Catholic Church-run school for Indigenous children in Canada. Local media reports say the graves were discovered during excavations at Maryvale Residential School in the province of Saskatchewan. The Federation of Sovereign Indigenous Nations says it has found a substantially significant number of new unmarked graves. Last month, the remains of 215 children were discovered at another former Indigenous residential school in the province of British Columbia. Since then, Indigenous leaders have been calling on authorities for a thorough investigation. Thousands of Indigenous children in Canada were forcibly separated from their families during the last century to be sent to residential schools, where many of them were subjected to ill treatment and sexual abuse. Brazil registers over 115,000 new COVID-19 cases, breaking its single-day record for infections of the coronavirus. The South American country's health ministry also registered nearly 2,400 new deaths from the virus. The latest figures have pushed the country's total to more than 507,000 fatalities out of more than 18 million confirmed cases of the virus. Brazil has witnessed the world's third worst outbreak and remains the second deadliest following the U.S. Meanwhile, the U.S. continues to grapple with the pandemic as vaccination slows in the country. The virus has so far claimed nearly 603,000 lives out of over 33.5 million cases in the world's worst-hit country. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Quraysh. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, peace be upon him, said, "Whoever gets a brother in Allah in addition to faith in Allah and faithfulness to his brotherhood seeking Allah's pleasure, gets a ray from Allah's light, safety from the punishment of Allah, a pilgrimage to Mecca through which he will be successful on the Day of Judgment, everlasting honor and increasing reputation. That is because the believer is neither mausul nor mafsul from Allah, the Great Almighty." He was asked, "What is the meaning of mausul and mafsul?" Imam Baqir, peace be upon him, replied, "Mausul meaning the believer is not connected to Allah, mafsul meaning the believer is not separated from Allah."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam urged his companions to treat people according to a certain rules of Islamic etiquettes, Islamic social conduct, if you will. Now, these Islamic etiquettes are prescribed by Allah, the creator of human beings and of humanity, in order to perfect and keep society and the world in general in harmony and in peace. So Imam al-Baqir was talking to his companions, and in this dialogue, Imam al-Baqir says to them, when talking about Islamic rules of social etiquettes and conduct, he said, "Obey the parents. take care of the poor neighbors, the needy, the debtors, the indebted, and the orphans. It's very beautiful, dear friends, but I read in one place that the true value and the true sophistication and civilization of a society is based upon how they treat their orphans. Now here Imam al-Baqir, he tells us that we should obey our parents, of course, when they tell us to do good. We shouldn't obey our parents if they tell us to do evil, right? But here we obey our parents when they tell us to do good. We take care of our poor neighbors. We take care of those that are needy, those that are indebted, especially when it comes to those who are within our own families. It is as they say, charity starts from home. We should help our near relatives. We should help our near friends before we go out to some random place or some random people and help them out. It is our responsibility to first and foremost help those that are close to us, such as our neighbors or such as the needy and the indebted and the orphans within our own close family circle and our circle of close friends. Of course, if everybody that we know in our close circle of friends, then we can start to expand our circle and go farther out. But dear friends, very beautiful and golden lessons here in this conversation by Imam al-Baqir, to obey our parents, to take care of the poor neighbors, to take care of the needy, to help the one who is indebted, and to help support, protect the orphans. In this dialogue by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Saudagar.
To try to relate our condition to the conditions of Imam al-Baqir, see some parallels, although it's not exactly the same. We do have some differences here. But I'm going to focus on the similarities. And then look at Imam al-Baqir, salamullahi alayhi, what he presented. There's a methodology that he presented. So the conditions that we have are the conditions very similar. You don't have too much of the actual sayings of the Ahlul Bayt, the actual sayings of the Prophet, available to the masses where they can see what the Prophet himself said, what the Ahlul Bayt themselves said. And there are a lot of attributions, there's a lot of narrations attributing words and actions to the Ahlul Bayt. And that combination creates the state of confusion. I think that anyone that can really look at and observe the Muslim community, and even within the Shia community, if you look at the Shia community outside of Muslim lands, I think confusion is the best description of it. We don't need any outsiders. We are fighting each other. We have found it to be more important to fight each other based on a certain understanding or the other understanding, then to be together and look at what others are doing against us, those who are against us, identifying those who are against us. There's a lot of people that aren't against us. We need to have thoughts and plans for that as well. There are those who are definitely against us. Without looking at that, we find it more interesting, intriguing to be at each other's throats and fight each other about this.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shandayati. In today's episode, we're discussing The Reagan Show, directed by Pacho Velez and Sierra Pattingill. And joining me in this episode are Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Neil Faulkner, who is a historian, writer, and author, and has a new edition of his book coming out soon, which is called A Radical History of the World. Now, made up entirely of archive news and White House footage, The Reagan Show is a documentary that captures the pageantry, absurdity, and mastery of the made-for-TV politics of Ronald Reagan during his two terms in office as the 40th president of the US. This documentary shows how the former Hollywood actor redefined the look and feel of what it means to be in the highest office in the world, and also his rivalry with former Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev during the Cold War era.
The Reagan administration will be remembered for excelling in public relations.
I think that he has captured the imagination of the American people because of his ability to communicate.
To be prepared for war is one of the most effectual means of preserving the peace. That's why New Hampshire needs John Sununu. Sununu. Together, we'll make America great again.
I think appearance is very important, but it's also staging. It's how you stage the message.
Not for me, honey.
It's a game.
That's it.
Super!
Well, if you'll pardon my stealing a film line, the force is with us.
You have stated flatly that you did not trade weapons for hostages.
What began as a strategic opening to Iran deteriorated in its implementation.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Happy New Year. Thank you. God bless you.
Cut.
Take that, Mr. Gorbachev.
So first of all, thanks for coming on. Very much welcome to the show. And I found this documentary to be incredibly an eye-opening insight into the superficial sort of role of the president in the U.S. And also, I suppose this documentary comes at a fitting time as we see many parallels between Trump and Reagan. And Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating sort of behind-the-scenes look. It's got that inbuilt nostalgia factor. I mean, Reagan himself kind of very much based his own persona on this kind of, you know, folksy, you know, bygone era charms, you know, referring back to his Hollywood career before he was a politician. And the film, because it's got that sort of, you know, the videotape and the sort of grainy look and everything, it's almost an inbuilt kind of nostalgia trip for anyone who remembers him from that time. I think as a film, because it sort of sticks so closely to the sort of found footage and, you know, commentary from the time, it allows viewers to make parallels. So, you know, in the trailer you see Reagan saying make America great again, which obviously we have more modern connotations to today, but it doesn't give you that sort of perspective of people commenting back from now to then and sort of maybe shaping a bit more the narrative of how we went from this sort of, you know, maybe more substance driven thing to a more sort of style and you know, pageantry and performance thing. So I understand why they've done it, and within the confines of the structure and the style that they use, it works. But there's a wider story that maybe would allow for more kind of, you know, nuance and reflection on how we got to that point.
So perhaps the onus of the documentary and the perspective is on the rests in the audience to figure out what's happening using the archive. You're forced to be guided through it, really, because without
the
narration.
No, for sure. I mean, you know, it's very much, it puts there and it's asking you, so, you know, how does that resonate today? And obviously there's a huge amount. It's like, you know, now it's Reagan on steroids, you know, because it's not just old style Hollywood production, it's social media, which is a whole different world, but reflects, you know, it's gone from that and it's sort of metastasized into something even more pernicious, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But I still think that there's an element there that what I would love to see, it's always, you know, you should never review the film that isn't made, but I would love to see him, how he went from actor to politician and used the media and the performance idea of that. It kind of starts, it's already fully formed. And we don't get a lot of analysis of how he became that, you know, ready-made image of a president.
So Neil, if I could bring you in here, that was a good point that Lee made. How did you find this documentary?
Well, I agree with everything that Lee has just said, and I think for me as a historian, the problem with it is, and as you say, we shouldn't be criticising the documentary that wasn't made, but the reality is that if you focus on the image, and the image was very, very powerful politically, it was very, very effective politically, because that avuncular, friendly, warm, genial, round-the-log-fire, all-American kind of image that was being very successfully promoted was a cover for a range of policies which were really quite pernicious. I mean, massive union busting operation going on, a driving down of wages, massive cuts to the poor, huge shifts in terms of tax cuts for the rich. So the poor were being penalised with benefit cuts while the rich were getting richer through the tax cuts. And this massive increase in military spending.
That's a really interesting point, and I want to delve into that issue a bit later on in the show.
We were riding to the airport yesterday afternoon, and my mother was talking about in Arkansas that they were trying to pass a law to give 150 or pay people standing in their home instead of going to the old folks' home. I made the comment, I said, I didn't think it should give anything. I thought we should take care of our own, you know, that's my feelings. My little one, I thought, was asleep in the back seat, and he raised up and he said, Granny, that's why Ronald Reagan's the president. Stop all these giveaway programs.
Tell me, you had the experience, Mr. President, at one time of auditioning for film roles, and then when you ran for governor and president, you were auditioning in front of the public for office. Which is more difficult?
Well, I have to say this one is, you have to, well, you not only have to get the part, you have to write the script.
And Neil, there's a moment in the documentary also that's quite revealing, and you see the mask slip a bit when you see that Reagan admits that it was actually easier to be an actor than it is to be a president. Mm. And he also says that he couldn't imagine being a president without being an actor also. What do you think the film implies then about the suitability of his character for a president?
Well, I think to a very large extent anyway, the American president is very often a figurehead who's controlled by other forces. I mean, I don't think Reagan was particularly bright. I don't think he was particularly well informed. He's supposed to have had a reputation of being very impatient of detail. I don't think he was a particularly quick thinker and so on. So I think we need to see him as, I mean, in a sense, the documentary is capturing this, isn't it? That he's the front man, he's the image, he's the folksy image, and the real hard policy is being decided by other people. And it was brutal policy, both domestically and in relation to what the US was doing internationally. So, yes, you could say the image is a construct, and he's quite a shallow figure, but hey, does that make any difference to the Reagan project actually being driven through by this administration? Because it was being driven through very effectively.
And Lee, what did you make of how this character, Reagan, was portrayed in this documentary?
Well, I mean, you know, I think with the best will in the world, even the biggest Ronald Reagan fans would not give him much credit as an actor. But he is uniquely suited for this sort of role because, as Neil says, he's got the best, you know, when he was a Hollywood actor, he never worked necessarily with the best filmmakers. Mm-hmm. When he's president, he's working with the very best people to stage and produce the theater that's going on. And he's got that sort of, I mean, yeah, I watched this very carefully. I don't think there's a moment where he's not smiling, or at least he never looks unhappy. Mm-hmm. He's always got that kind of, the lights are on, you know, I'm on stage, you know, and you saw him in the clip before, he ushers people towards the mic. He's so aware of, you know, his role within the production. So he succeeds so much better as a president than he ever did as an actor, mm-hmm. and that's fascinating to me because you would think one has a lot bigger stakes and is a lot, you know, you need a much better, you know, person at the job to succeed as president, but actually a sort of very average to mediocre actor can, you know, whether you agree with the policies or not, be a very successful president in terms of putting his message across.
That is really interesting. And we do learn that actually he's been in 53 Hollywood movies or so.
It's a film about Reagan's years in office and looking at those years through the lens of PR, and in particular how he used PR and public relations to fight the Cold War by making a film that let you watch Reagan go from his roles in Hollywood eventually to the presidency. You'd sort of see how his work in Hollywood informed his performance as a politician. So I found this archive called the White House Television Archive that was commissioned and overseen by the Reagan administration. 2,000 hours of footage documenting Reagan's time in office, Dr. Reagan was the subject of the archive, but he was also kind of its author. And as I'm making this film, sometimes I like to joke that Reagan's actually, in some ways, deserves a co-director credit.
So Neil, I just wanted to ask you to shed more political context on Reagan during the time. What was the political landscape like, and why was he elected?
I think there's a huge shift going on in the 1970s. The 1970s is a period of major crisis inside a lot of Western states, where there's a wave of radicalization, of union struggle, advances by social movements, and so on. And also internationally, US imperialism was on the back foot. In the 1970s, it suffered a series of very significant setbacks: the defeat in Vietnam, losing ground in Southern Africa, losing ground in Central Asia, losing ground in Central America as well, with the Nicaraguan Revolution at the end of the 1970s. And I think Reagan represents two things. He represents a kind of counterattack by the corporations and the rich inside America against workers, against the poor, and against the social movements. And internationally, an attempt to reassert U.S. imperial control over what is effectively an informal empire. They want to shore up U.S. power at a time when the U.S. economy is weakening, and that weakening of economic clout, which had been crucial to U.S. power in the 50s and the 60s, to some degree you can compensate for that by substituting a more aggressive military stance. And I think that's what's happening under Reagan.
And in this documentary, you learned that he was called a trigger-happy president. Although he said he strived for peace, we saw sort of contradictions there.
Yes. No, that's absolutely right, because there's this massive, massive increase in arms expenditure, which brings it right up to the level that it was at the beginning of the Cold War in the early 1950s. And it creates a huge economic problem for the United States, a massive, massive budget deficit. I mean, all this stuff, you know, all this neoliberal stuff they're saying about how we need to control our budgets and we don't want big government, it's all nonsense. If you look at the military expenditure and the way it's being funded by borrowing, it has a crippling effect on the US economy in the long run. But what it does do is it breaks the back, this is the crucial thing, I think, of the Soviet Union. Because the Soviet Union, a much smaller economy and a failing economy, simply can't match these levels of arms expenditure. You've got a second Cold War, which in a sense, Reagan wins by just upping the stakes to a level which the Soviets can't match.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up that point in the next part of the discussion, actually. And Lee, if I could ask you, did you see any similarities between Reagan and Trump? Because many critics are drawing many similarities between them and parallels.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that Trump would love to be, you know, as idolized as Reagan. And, you know, the whole Make America Great Again, which you hear Reagan say very early on in this documentary, you know, there's no, that's not a coincidence. He's trying to echo the sort of style. The difference is, and again, regardless if you agree with the policies, Reagan has a charm and a sort of, you know, acceptability to a large number of people. Trump obviously has a base. I mean, he won the election, even if he lost the popular vote. But it's kind of, you know, right-wing Republicanism with the mask off. It's the sort of the aggression and the kind of tit-for-tat stuff and the sort of intolerance which was, you know, largely covered by Reagan's, you know, kind of charm and sort of, you know, persona. That's all gone. And what's interesting now is it's like you don't even need that cover, it seems, at the moment to kind of succeed. And that's quite a sort of fairly terrifying development, I would say.
Indeed, and critics say that Reagan set the precedent for today's facts don't matter politics. And critics also say that Trump sort of coined this fake news sort of propaganda and techniques from the Reagan era. And we heard in the documentary, actually, that Reagan was aware of the frenzy he would cause with the media just to be able to dodge questions, so to speak. So do you think that there are similarities between the two?
Yeah, but and we must be careful. I mean, fake news is a current term, but politicians have always lied, especially when they're defending a vested interest. They've always lied to the people. So we need to be quite careful. And that's, you know, that's the old word, really, for fake news, in a sense. But I think it is true there's been a ramping up of that. And Reagan starts it, and it's now at an absolutely epidemic level, I think, with Trump and with the Tory government in Britain as well. We've actually got to a point where lying has become, fake news if you like, lying seems to have become pretty much systematic and institutionalized. So politicians are completely routinely saying the opposite to the public of what is actually happening behind the scenes. And it's there with Reagan, because everything Reagan is saying about, you know, this is a struggle between right and wrong, this is a crusade for freedom, Russia is the evil empire, all of this kind of stuff, this Cold War rhetoric that's being pumped out, is hiding, I mean, terrible atrocities and injustices which are being perpetrated by American imperialism.
I'll have to pause you there. We will pick up that more in the next part.
Gorbachev seems to be most confident that he can outperform Ronald Reagan. He's feeling comfortable, he's feeling good about the way things are going, and he thinks that he should be able to strut his stuff as well on the world stage.
It is Gorbachev who is very vocal with the press, talking, right, laughing, smiling. It is Mr. Reagan who is sitting back, speaking monosyllabically. Now, why isn't Mr. Reagan coming forward in the way that we've seen in the past?
Gorbachev is trying to win through public opinion what he doesn't necessarily get at the negotiating table. If he can gain leverage against the United States through his propaganda efforts, then he can win something at the table.
And so the stage is set for Mr. Reagan and Gorbachev to report on their summit. With every indication, they will call it a success. But behind all the smiles and rhetoric, the question is whether they have really done something to make the world breathe easier.
So we see a lot of Gorbachev featuring in this documentary, and I think he's portrayed in a more charismatic light, and he seems to come across as a more bold leader than Reagan from the media clips that we've seen in this film. Lee, can I ask you, what did you make of their rivalry and how Gorbachev was portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the film is the Reagan show, and it obviously concentrates on Reagan, but Gorbachev becomes a major player within the film because it kind of builds, you know, the Cold War as the overarching narrative for it. He comes across as incredibly charismatic and very intelligent, and I think what you see is there's a section where they show that actually the Russians or the Soviet Union hire an American PR firm to help with their own promotion and, you know, marketing effectively. So it's very clear that, I think the other thing we have to be really careful is, this is not just an American or a Western thing, this performance thing. Every country indulges in this. Every nation, you know, distorts the views that they need to sort of, you know, win the public opinion and stuff. It's not just the States, it's not just the West. And you see how the Soviet Union becomes very adept very quickly, and it's also got a very media-savvy figurehead who can basically go toe-to-toe with Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I think as much as Reagan obviously, you know, had a big part to play in the Cold War, I think you underestimate Gorbachev's role also doing that, whether it's only because, you know, the Soviet Union couldn't afford an arms race, but I think, you know, you could also look at it in a positive way and say, yes, there's also an impetus to try and break this kind of escalation that's going on.
And that is a good point, actually. It does make you think, this documentary, about how intertwined the media and politics are. And Neil, I just wanted to quickly touch on how Star Wars was introduced in this documentary, and was seen as actually not existing, and it was a PR stunt to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. How accurate is this?
I think the Star Wars initiative was very, very real. I mean, I think this is why it's true to call it the Second Cold War, because if the US had developed a technology to shoot missiles down from space, the effect would have been that the mutually assured destruction, which had basically acted as a mutual deterrent, would suddenly have gone. The Russians were genuinely very, very frightened by this development and couldn't match it. They didn't have the technology and they didn't have the economic resources. And I think that that is a stick with which to beat Gorbachev. You see, I think Gorbachev was actually a more serious political player than Reagan. I think he really was driving it. I mean, what you see actually on the screen with Gorbachev is real. He's the young reformer who really is trying to transform the Soviet Union. And behind the scenes, what's actually happening is Reagan and his advisors are not giving much ground at all, particularly on Star Wars. And it's actually the Russians who make all of the concessions because they're so desperate.
Yes, we do see it, especially from this documentary, that the Americans are on the back foot. And so the final 20 seconds to you, Lee, as we're running out of time, would you recommend this documentary?
I would. I mean, it's a fascinating look at, you know, an era that really where video and, you know, the performance aspect came to power. You you could argue that, you know, this is not, it didn't start with Reagan. You think of Kennedy and Nixon and the TV debates that people thought TV Kennedy won and radio thought Nixon won. But, it, you know, it's, it shows that it got ramped up in, at this moment, and it had a Hollywood actor. So it's kind of a perfect, you know, Hollywood movie. You know, the medium becomes the message, basically.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I'm afraid we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Chambiati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.